Verily, this vicious swaze of verbiage veers most verbose, so let me simply add that it's my very good honor to meet you, and you may call me V.
My spider senses are starting to tingle.
Just hang on to your lariat. Wonder what kind of a scene I'm getting into.
And welcome to issue 92 of Behind the Panels, the comic book show that forgot the 5th of November. I'm Richard Gray.
I'm David McVeigh, who almost forgot to turn the volume up.
Oh. And I'm David Longo.
In this issue, Kevin Smith is back writing comics. Expect the first issue this year and the second sometime in 2017. Then Captain America is set to go head-to-head with Batman and Superman. It's the most expensive game of chicken ever. Plus, our kick-ass pick of the week, V for Vendetta by Alan Moore and David Lloyd. This is Behind the Panels. Yes, I'm not familiar with that song, are you?
I was about to say, and chaos is the name of the day, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, anarchy in the UK, that's right. We're sitting here with V, ready to smash stuff up, aren't we, gents? Let's get out our knuckle dusters, shall we? This is a bit, well, go from a bit of that to a bit of this today, because we've got Alan Moore.
He's live in the studio today.
He's live here. Hello, gents, I heard one of you worked in a library. I thought I'd come on to talk about my least popular book.
Is it really?
No, actually, it's not his least popular book at all. It's probably the
that would be Promethea.
Promethea, yeah. It would probably well, actually, there's probably a few that line
up before
that. It is the.
They're
book
all written on hashish, so it's okay.
It is apparently LSD.
It is the book that LSD is mentioned in this a few times, but it is the book that he claimed, or he cites as the first. He's one of his first attempts, along with Marvel Man / Miracle Man, as his first attempt at an ongoing.
Correct.
And it began its life in Warrior, as we'll talk about a little later, which was a serialized anthology type deal, rather than as single standalone issues, which is where most people read it much later in 1988. But he started this back as early as 1981.
And you can actually feel that it really does have its roots firmly placed in that era.
So even though it came out after Watchmen, it's very much early Alan Moore.
Yeah.
So a really interesting book to look at.
So you're telling me this wasn't written about the Bush administration?
Apparently not. No.
Oh, damn.
No.
I got to reread it quickly.
Yeah.
The parallels are there.
Margaret who?
I don't know what we normally do at this point. What do we normally do?
We normally have a vintage clip of the week, I believe.
I'm so enthused. Those of you who listened to GMC last week will know that we got new mics, and I'm just so baffled by this new object sitting in front of my face that I've forgotten completely what I normally do.
I believe
do.
One of our listeners said that you needed to have a mirror so you could look at yourself talking.
I'm just fascinated by it. No, you've turned the volume down on me deliberately so I can't hear my own voice. That's what you've done here. But instead of doing that, I'm going to do a bit of this.
Now, Super Knave, thou canst not escape from the magic sword.
But the magic sword can escape from you. Watch. Great work, Superboy!
Odds, Butkins. He's stuck again.
You bet it is your Black Knight ship.
Guards, seize the traitorous Black Knight!
Attaboy, Your Majesty!
Mercy, Your Majesty. It was Merlin who
seize Merlin, too.
I shall return.
Jeepers, he vanished.
Thank you, Majesty. I am not a magician, but if you'd like to see one trick, watch this. Ready, Timmy?
You bet.
Okay, hang on.
I know we carry a clean tag on this show. Well, we actually don't. We don't carry any tag.
We try to.
But can I just tell you that my mind, when he goes, want to see my next trick? Ready, Timmy? I was waiting for a zip to go
particularly
down.
Particularly given that the next sound effect is...
Yeah.
Unleash your mighty sword.
Which got stuck. The Black Knight sword got stuck.
Yeah,
I'm
let's
not
just leave it right
that's
there.
Where your mind goes. My mind just automatically goes to the soundtracks. Every time Richard plays one of these clips now, I just start hearing...
And as I said last week, do you know how hard it was finding something that didn't have meanwhile? You know, it was just... which is going to be, I reckon we should just rename the show Meanwhile.
Great name for a podcast.
That clip was old.
Gee Willikers, boss.
I love it how we're just riffing on our own jokes now. Yeah. It's great. That's what we've just
we've got to that point.
Well, you know, if we don't, who will?
For both of you listening out
we could
there,
become real is... big nerds about our own show.
Yeah.
Remember in issue 41 of Behind the Panel? I believe it was
we
you,
need...
Richard, that fed the
and
Guardian.
And next week's pick of the week is this week's episode.
Can I tell you, do you know what we need? We
that
need...
would be cool. I do want to do that where we just play a minute of the audio and then talk about it.
I think what we need is we need a very industrious listener out there to create a Wikipedia entry for this show. Ooh. Where they actually outline all the stuff we talk about and,
yeah,
the, and
the structure of the show.
All the changes that have happened, the guests and so forth. I think if it's somebody's out there who wants to create that Wikipedia page,
totally.
I'm in.
Because like we're not allowed to do it.
We're not allowed to create our own. So. Yeah.
Like a concordance. Because then when we're like 45 years old, or when I am, then we can like write books about the creation of Behind the Panels without having to listen to all the audio.
How cool would it be if somebody was started listening and said, I want to know more about these hosts, they could Wikipedia it and we'd actually be there.
Hey. Wow. And when I'm 45 years old, you'll be the age that I am now.
Whoa. Whoa.
But that's why this podcast is even-handed.
And when Dave is 45, I may not be here.
No, you'll be frozen in cryogenic sleep.
We're basically...
That's what I want.
Well, my head will be because I can't afford the whole body.
We're the thing... We're the theme of Clerks 1, 2, and 3 here, I think, between us.
Yes, we cover the entire spectrum.
Hey, speaking of Kevin Smith.
Where? Looks like we got ourselves a reader. Read between the lines, bitch.
That bit.
Nice segue, bit.
Yeah.
Nice segue, that.
I just had to move us on somehow. And it all gone mad. I got nothing else, though. No, this week was an interesting week for new releases. In fact, we'll just say up front, we're actually going to try and mix this up a little bit more because we've been doing just new releases and what we've been reading. But that's not all we read.
We
read
all
other
read
stuff as well.
Yeah.
I never learnt to read. I was going to put that out there. I look at the pictures. So it's really for me.
And I read the words to him.
Yeah. So for me,
ask them what they thought of it and then pretend that I've read it.
So for me, it's really what I've been watching and hearing.
Very good.
As David reads out, panel one.
And Richard every now and again goes, what's he saying here?
And he goes, do you know what that word is? No, I really don't.
Imagine a 4x4-inch box. There are two figures inside. One is Spider-Man. The other is...
Oh, my God, it's hot.
If we tried to do that for a Chris Claremont book, we'd be here for hours. Avengers Undercover number one, Captain Marvel number one, and Secret Avengers number one with three all-new Marvel Now titles that came out this week. I read a lot of those. Quickly want to cover Avengers Undercover and Secret Avengers. Avengers Undercover was, before we talk about the one I really want to talk about, which is Captain Marvel. Mm. Avengers Undercover was interesting because it's kind of a follow-up to the Avengers Arena, whatever it was called, where it was actually the Battle Royale
thing. Yeah.
And it's the survivors of that. And the consequences.
So is Avengers Arena finished now?
It is finished,
yeah. Oh, thank God for that.
So this is survivors of that and what they're doing now that they're out and they're celebrities and the whole world was watching it, you know, watching these kids murder each other as entertainment. It's kind of the consequences of that, which I think is an interesting concept.
But Marvel's Hunger Games.
It's Marvel's Hunger Games, basically, yeah. This is their Catching Fire or Mockingjay or something, basically. Far more interesting was Secret Avengers.
Now, I have to ask about this because I didn't get a chance to read Secret Avengers, but I was reading the previous incarnation of this before the renumbering, and Secret Avengers was Black Widow and... it was kind of a really covert operation. And is this continuing on with that?
Yeah, basically the lineup for this, it's still a covert operation. The lineup is Nick Fury
Jr.
I guess. Yeah. Hawkeye, Black Widow, Spider-Woman, Phil Coulson, and wait for it, MODOK.
Pardon?
Yeah. who is not officially part of the group, but of course not. It's really interesting. This is written by Alice Cott, who has written recent things like Zero and so forth. The art in here is by Michael Walsh, and I absolutely love this art. And the page I'm holding up, I know you're going to love, David.
Oh, very nice.
It's really got that great back and forth dialogue stuff, because a lot of this issue is almost like Hawkeye in the sense that it's what they do on the day off. But then they're actually attacked, but the way they react is like their characters in a Matt Fraction book would react, which I think is really, really interesting. So like, it's just one of the opening pages is Black Widow and Spider-Woman, or you know, Natasha and Jessica getting a massage together while eating ice cream.
And we've kind of seen this motif before, because we've had Carol Danvers and Black Widow during the Age of Ultron series.
But then the masseuse presses a button on the wall and this whole armory opens up in front of them. So you get that kind of thing. And then Hawkeye's being chased by AIM goons, and they all have to get together. And basically the issue ends with a naked Hawkeye and the two of them having to hop into a ship together, and Hawkeye just happened to be there. He's not officially part of the Secret Avengers.
Look how they've censored his...
Yeah, and they've actually censored it. There's a point where he walks in naked and they've got the head of Hawkeye.
A trick that Matt Fraction
did,
yeah.
So they've borrowed a lot of that stuff. They all end up going into space at one point, so which is where the second issue kicks off. So we'll kick off, I imagine. There's a really great spoilers here. There's one point where Maria Hill's shot through the hand and she's just looking through a hole in the hand, sort of like... not quite sure, and they framed the person that shot her through the hole in the hand, which is beautiful. It's a beautiful art, beautiful concept. Really, and this is for me. This is the new series to watch as part of the all new Marvel Now, because it's got the vibe of all those things like Hawkeye and whatnot.
Well, previous to Marvel Now, I was actually a very big Secret Avengers fan. I thought the original Secret Avengers that was actually spawned out of things like Civil War and Siege was a really good series. So it's nice, and I wasn't particularly keen on the Marvel Now incarnation of it. I was okay, but I kind of was missing my Secret Avengers, so maybe we're in business.
I should mention, because I don't think I mentioned the name of the artist, is Michael Walsh, who is fantastic, and the colouring and this is amazing. The colourist on this is Matthew Wilson.
Oh, okay.
So definitely a combination that works as well as, you know, AHA, Hollingsworth, or any of those.
I will be reading this after the show.
I'm very excited by this title. Didn't know anything about it going in, so for me this was a discovery this week. One that wasn't a discovery at all, because I knew I'd be getting into it as soon as it came out, was the new Captain Marvel.
I'm going to say to this is, Kelly Sue DeConnick, you're back, baby.
Oh, this is... Kelly Sue, we've missed ye.
Yeah.
This is a great book, and it's one of those answers first, questions later kind of setups, because it starts off and it goes back 6 months. But really, back 6 weeks, rather. It's got some great moments between her and Iron Patriot. Mm-hmm. Going through there.
I was actually unaware that they were in a relationship. When did that start?
No, I didn't know that either. It was only when he pulled her behind the shed or whatever it was.
Rhodey and Danvers. I had no idea they were in a relationship. That must have happened in one of the other Avengers titles.
And, you know, they're all living inside the Statue of Liberty.
Finale of the last series of Captain Marvel. What I really liked about this, and I know this is a little bit controversial, but I love Kelly Sue DeConnick's writing, but the artwork style was actually really starting to irritate me a little bit at the end of the last run.
I wasn't the biggest fan of that.
And I was getting, because it was getting more and more impressionistic as it was going on, and it was just starting to irk me a little bit. And the artwork in this is beautiful. The artwork has gone back to a traditional style.
David Lopez, and particularly, look, I think colorists now are just as much responsible.
Very important.
And these colorists they've got on the New 52, on the all new Marvel Now, and are really, really amazing stuff. This is Lee Luffridge doing this again, another person up there with the greats. Because it's got a really good feel to this comic that's a kind of, you know, kind of sort of a lighter, more effeminate look, because it is Captain Marvel somehow, but without being... So I should say it's lighter without being effeminate.
Yeah.
It's still a strong, bold style, but it lends itself to Captain Marvel.
How important the colorist is, I've said this forever we've been talking about this, that as much as I like Amanda Connor is nothing without Paul Mounts.
Yeah.
Paul Mounts is the color of her, you know?
So. I also love all the moments between Carol and Tony Stark as well. Yes. There's some really, really nice dialogue between
them. I also love the relationship she has with the child. I think that little girl she calls Lieutenant. The Lieutenant, yeah. I think, and that she is just fabulous. And I think there's that beautiful moment where she says, "Where have you been?" The mother says, "Where have you been?" She goes, "I was waiting up for her to make sure she was okay." She goes, "You don't have to look after her." She goes, "Yes, I do." You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I think it's just one, it's a beautiful, beautiful relationship that she's formed with this child.
And I think that's been the real strength of Kelly Sue's Captain Marvel. She's made her such a human character rather than, you know, the pin-up girl that was the previous incarnation of Carol Danvers. Mm-hmm.
She feels more multidimensional than a lot of superheroes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if you want an example, if there's been a lot of hints that Carol Danvers / Captain Marvel will be making some part of the next phase of Marvel films. As Kevin Feige's almost come out and said it's going
to
happen.
It has to.
If they're looking at a strong female-led superhero film, and look, this is a sidebar. Someone actually put up an infographic recently about female action heroes, and they were talking about the two most successful, to use a parallel to comics, the two most successful game franchises that have, in terms of dollars, the Tomb Raider franchise and the Resident Evil franchise, mm-hmm. both have strong female action hero leads, and no one batted an eyelid at saying, you know, put them in a different category somehow. They were both just strong action films that the audience didn't stop going to because, yeah, why would we want to see, Miller running around in a tight outfit kicking ass, you know? No one ever stopped and said that. It was kind of like, it was just taken for granted that was a going to be a strong action film because it had a really good fan base and had a really good mythology behind it. Same as this. I mean, there's no, if anyone can pull this off, Marvel's going to do it well. I think rather than early indications of what Batman versus Superman versus Wonder Woman versus everything else. So, look, you know, I think this is a great template. I think if Guardians gets pulled off as a success, I think we're going to see a bit more experimentation.
We have two untitled Marvel films.
We do.
And both of those are open slates, and both of them could be anything at
this
point.
So, late 2016 and the first one in 2017. Yeah. The question is,
does Captain Marvel debut in her own film, or does she debut in the Avengers?
I think there's rumors going around that they might introduce her earlier, but you know, who knows at this point.
And sidebar.
Look, I mean, that I just wanted to mention that quickly. Jumping over to DC briefly while we're still on the majors.
What's DC up to now?
Yeah, exactly. Have I still got that on the soundboard? Or have I? Oh no, I got rid of it because I don't. You know, I stopped caring. But honestly, Batman and Batgirl and Justice League of America 13 were the three titles that you kind of have to read for the ongoing.
And can I say that Batgirl was actually a little disappointing?
Really? I really liked it.
I liked the writing.
Yeah.
I think that Gail Simone is still a great writer.
Yeah.
I thought the plotting was flawed. And I actually think that
I really liked the twist.
And I thought the conclusion was weak. The twist was good. I liked the little twist with the girl, you know, but I thought overall,
it felt rushed.
I thought it was going to go on a lot longer actually. Yeah. Yes. And it was all like, as soon as the twist happened, it's like, oh, okay, we're all friends now. And it's like,
yeah,
what happened? This was setting up a major new villain.
You know, I would not be surprised, and I could be talking out of school here, that she probably plotted this out longer, but there's been so many interruptions to Batgirl with other events like Gothtopia and Forever Evil and all that, that she had to squeeze her story into two issues so they could go on to the next bit.
And, you know, I may have actually been better off. I may have actually liked it more had it not been so on the nose for one panel.
Oh, yeah. Okay, look, spoilers.
Spoilers for everything.
They introduce a character who walks in and they say, "Well, who are you?" And he responds with, I Vampire.
Which, of course, was the name of another book.
Yeah, which was cancelled.
And they're just bringing the character back. But it was so on the nose, this panel, because it's just like, yeah, we had a book called I, Vampire.
I thought it was pretty tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, I like the relationship between Strix and
I think that's fantastic.
And Babs.
And I love the idea that this bad guy is bathing and drinking nothing but holy water. I think this is brilliant.
Yeah.
And I think that character is a brilliant character.
Which led to a brilliant conclusion.
Absolutely. You know? And I just think that for the amount of setup we had an entire issue of setup, it was over like that. you know?
I think that, at some level, I think that's what she was going for, because she wanted that really shock ending that you kind of go, oh, right, that's all we had to do. Mm. Okay.
And as I said,
and really in the end, Batgirl and Strix really had didn't have much to do.
No. And overall, as
the thing resolved itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that Batgirl is still one of the DC titles to read.
Yeah.
So don't think I'm bagging out on it. I just think that this is not one of my favorite issues.
Fair enough.
Happened.
But I think it'd be interesting to see what happens going forward with the next issues. Batman. Right. Mm. So
and so they also released Justice League.
No, we should talk about Batman.
I really want to talk
about
Batman. I, over at Newsarama, I basically, I wrote a review that, that my editor said, wow, way to slam DC in your first paragraph. Because I won't dwell on this because I don't like to dwell on the negative, but I've made no secret about the fact that this origin story seems to be part of a DC mandate to really overcomplicate every origin story. And to me, it kind of is the antithesis of what the New 52 is about, which is easy jump-on points for new readers. And to me, when you have a new year-long origin story, that's the antithesis of what New 52 is about. It's meant to be about a new place for people to jump on. If you're reading this monthly, it's frustrating. Once it's released as a trade, it'll make sense for a new reader to pick up the trade.
But the problem is that there are still a lot of people like us who read monthly.
Well, no.
It's not catering to us.
And it's not catering to us. But I just don't understand how this gels with the New 52 philosophy. You know, I don't understand it at all.
Dave Longo and I were sitting at the coffee shop prior to recording this show, and we were actually talking about this very issue.
You hussies.
And I think we came to the conclusion that it's not so much that I think this is the style of the New 52 or whatever. I actually think, personally, Snyder is treading water.
Mm.
I think Snyder is waiting for Forever Evil to finish so that he can get back to his story, and he's just milking this.
This is what actually blew my mind. It cleared up a lot for me because I can't stand reading this book anymore. Every month it just becomes more and more grating.
It just feels like it's dragging now.
It just drags on and on. You know, I don't need like 4,000 word balloons to tell me. Like,
I'm not entirely sure that that's what he's doing. I think he's just gotten carried away with a story which is way bigger than it has to be. It's become at this point, like, apart from, I don't know what he's actually added to the Batman origin story that has enhanced my knowledge of the character. And, you know, he could have told multiple stories in that time. If he was just treading water, he could have told, a 6-issue origin story. He could have told, you know, a couple of issues where he's fighting some random villain because there's stacks of them, you know, other backstories, whatever. The fact that he's deliberately chosen to do a year-long, year-one arc, because it is 0 year. So you get 12 issues of the 0 year. And it's not just the 0 year. It's burst out into all these other books as well. It's a proper event. It's an editorial DC decision to do this.
Mm. The funny
it's
thing
not
is,
just his little dalliance.
The funny thing is, this Riddler story that is being told right now could just be in the main storyline.
There's no reason.
There's no reason it has to be in order.
And it's frustrating because if spoilers if you haven't caught up yet, but if they are blowing up half the freaking city, how does that work? This is all prequel. It's prequel. So we know he gets out. There's no drama.
Mm.
There's no drama whatsoever. So to me, I don't like that type of prequel story. Given that Frank Miller was able to tell year one in 4 issues, this to me smacks of commercialism. And it's something that, you know, it's why the Batman books are still in the top 10.
And this is like the flagship title. Hey?
This is the flagship title.
I've been with it since the beginning. Since New 52 started, I've read every issue, including the annuals and everything. But I got to tell you, I'm up to the point where I may stop reading Batman
for a while,
build them up, and then read them as a trade.
I don't want to slag it out, but
I'll say something positive about it, because I think Greg Capullo is doing the best work he's ever done in this book.
Which is my other point, though.
Yeah.
His art is phenomenal in this
magic.
Issue.
Yes. And that's what's keeping me going through it. But I mean, like, it's so frustrating when you see this beautiful, beautiful drawing from Greg Capullo, and then next to it there's this huge word balloon where it's like just a mechanic telling us about how he was born in Chicago and he moved to Gotham and he decided to get like a couple of donuts one morning and now he's reminded of the donuts because of the color of the rain hitting the lights. It's just like so overindulgent where like he could just tell a good story, you know?
How beautiful was that shot of the bat blimp coming out of there.
Magnificent.
Coming
yeah.
out. And, but there's lots of moments like
that. I love the fact that it's censored too.
Yeah, the thing is, ultimately, and this is what I said on Newsarama, that you ultimately, because this thing is just so blown out.
My name's Trevor.
Yeah. Holy hell.
Trevor's playing all by himself.
I'm an actor.
The Mandarin's in the house for no apparent reason. Spoilers if you haven't seen Iron Man 3.
He doesn't read Year Zero, so it's alright.
The thing is, if what was I saying? If you're I think I've lost my train of thought. Now thanks, Trevor.
Sorry, Trevor.
No, but I mean there is some really genuinely good action moments in this. And that's what I was going to say. At this point, you just have to treat this as a roller coaster and live it from moment to moment because there's no other option.
No, and I absolutely agree with you. And that's what I'm saying. I don't want to just put Batman aside because I think it's a great book. Don't get me wrong. I still think Snyder's one of the best modern, one of the best new writers out there.
And we have to spend time talking about this because it is Snyder, it is Batman, it is the flagship book of
All I'm saying is I think I need to give it a rest so that I can pick it up as a trade later.
So you're not reading Batman, you're not reading X-Men.
I know. I'm running out of books here.
But see, like when you evaluate it at the end of the issue, it's like not much happened in it. If Hades had a really good editor to go through, I'm at the point now where I'm
reading. Well, he's got a new editor now. There's a new group editor for Batman.
You could read it and you could get a permanent marker in your right hand and you could go through and just mark out like every second word out of it. And you could easily cut it down to something actually readable.
Yes. Mm. Okay, quickly, I'll just mention the other stuff that came out this week because we don't have time to talk about it. Returning number one came out from IDW. It's a new miniseries. I'm up to date with these, but I haven't read the recent one of X-Files Conspiracy, The Crow. What I did read was a start of a new miniseries called Monster and Madman, which is by Steve Niles. The artwork's great, but it's basically a Frankenstein, Jack the Ripper mashup, and it's not very good.
And Jack the Ripper doesn't come into it until the last panel.
So it's very weird. But also go check out Mercenary C number 2. We banged on about Mercenary C before, and David won't have read it because he's not reading X-Men at the moment. But all new X-Men number 24, which I think is part 5 of...
Guess what happens now in the Trial of Green Drinker.
Next week...
I'll find out the conclusion when Guardians comes out.
Oh, it's so rubbish. Anyway, that's all I'll say.
Can I just say anything else that anyone's read that they want to mention?
No, that's
okay.
It.
So next week, which is the 19th of March releases, we see the all new Ghost Rider number 1. Which is Ghost Rider in a car.
I'm watching the next one, quite frankly.
But the next one, we're definitely looking forward to Daredevil number 1, which is the return of the Wade, Somni, Rodriguez run. Can't wait. Ms. Marvel number 2.
Looking forward to that too.
Really good book. Winter Soldier, The Bit of March number 2. That was a fantastic first issue, I'm really looking forward to that. There's a new Rocky and Bullwinkle comic from IDW.
Hey, did we mention we're seeing Captain America next week?
We're seeing, ooh. We will actually, next week's show, I'm sorry, David, we're going to do this. We're going to actually mention a little bit about Captain America, the Winter Soldier.
I don't get to see until a week after that.
Our embargo drops about a minute after we see the film, so we'll come in and talk about that. You can turn your headphones off, David.
That's right. I don't care about spoilers, you know that.
We won't spoil it.
Also coming out next week is our good friend Laramie Taylor's A Voice in the Dark number 5. I've got read the issue. It's great book, so definitely go check that out. The Noah hardcover. This is in anticipation of Darren Aronofsky's new film,
which I'm seeing in 2 weeks.
I'll be there with you. Sovereign number 1's coming out. Forever Evil Argus number 6. Justice League 29. Harley Quinn number 4. We're definitely looking forward to a new series from Dark Horse called Witcher number 1. I haven't read season 9 yet, but Buffy the Vampire Slayer season 10 number 1 kicks off next week. And also, speaking of Scott Snyder, American Vampire returns with a second cycle starting next week. I've got to catch up on
If you had asked me like before Year Zero, I would be foaming at the mouth for this.
Yeah.
Because I adore American Vampire. I hope it's as good as it was.
Well, kids, I think it's time for some news headlines. What do you reckon?
Let's do it.
Kevin Smith, Ralph Garman, and Ty Templeton will join forces for an upcoming crossover between DC's Batman 66 and Dynamite's Green Hornet.
Cool. Marvel and DC have been shut out of the February bookstore charts, with Walking Dead, Attack on Titan, Saga, and other indies dominating the top 20.
That's phenomenal. Boom has announced a first look deal with Cartoon Network for comics and graphic novels.
The Marvel has announced a series of short documentaries at South by Southwest called Tales to Astonish.
Tales!
Starting with Civil War, they aim
Sybil?
To they aim to put major Marvel stories into a wider context.
The Goon and Dream Thief return in Dark Horse's June solicitations.
Marvel Studios will release Captain America 3 on 6th of May 2016, lining it up against Batman versus Superman.
Who will win in the ultimate showdown?
Cap is going to shoot them down.
Marvel's next Infinite comic, that's the digital run, will be Marvel Universe Ultimate Spider-Man. The 24-part digital comic will see headline creators Eugene Sun, Matt Kent, Cullen Bunn, and Tim Seeley writing.
New Zealand-born Rose MacGyver, best known as playing Tinkerbell on ABC's Once Upon a Time, has been cast in the lead role of Olivia Liv Moore on the CW and Warner Brothers TV's loose adaptation of iZombie.
Finally, 300 Rise of an Empire, which we talked about last week, based on Frank Miller's unpublished graphic novel, sort of, took $45 million in its opening weekend with an estimated $147 million worldwide at the time of recording.
It's a hit, gentlemen. Whoa. It also absolutely shot down Sherman and Peabody.
Quiet, you.
Which also opened this week and was destroyed by these numbers. So,
well, you know, you can't...
Can't keep a good Spartan down.
You can't face or a good Athenian. Oh, you can't face off sweaty, abbed men in cloaks with a dog. Dog in glasses who adopts a small boy. Or maybe it's the Eva Green appeal.
Maybe. No, I think it's the Eva Green appeal.
Eva. Oh, well, let's look at something slightly less sweaty. Let's do the Kick-Ass Pick of the Week.
Well, see how you like this.
What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's awfully funny.
It's the pick of the week.
Remember, remember the 5th of November, the gunpowder, treason, and plot. I know of no reason why the gunpowder treason should ever be forgot.
Often cited as Alan Moore's first major work, V began his life in the pages of Warrior, but would have its greatest successes as this 10-issue series from DC's Vertigo imprint in 1988. Influenced by equal parts Orwell and Thatcherite Britain, the masked anarchist V systematically takes out the political figures and totems of the fascist regime that now rules the UK. Supported by David Lloyd's pastel-coloured art, this is anarchy against fascism. This is V for Vendetta. May England prevail.
Brought to you by the voice of fate. All right, boys. What do we reckon? Good? Bad? Worth a read? Yeah? Do it.
No. This is Comics 101.
We're done.
Yeah. All right. So next week.
This is a true masterwork.
Yeah.
This is, and what's interesting is if you actually read the Alan Moore intro, which actually comes from the 90s or late 80s.
88. It actually went.
Yeah, 88.
Yeah.
He actually says that it was, as you said in the intro, it's his first attempt at an ongoing, and he actually thinks the beginning of the book is really shaky, and he actually found his feet by the second half. And it's true. He does. The beginning of the book does kind of feel a little bit rudderless, but it very quickly finds its feet and very quickly directs itself in. Dave,
you read this. Mm-hmm. You were saying last week that you read this for quite recently. So, what are your thoughts on this?
I've read the book about four times. I think I was going to reread it again for today's show, but obviously time, you know, demanding at the moment. So I had a good look through, though, and I read some articles and some interviews with Alan Moore. I mean, V for Vendetta is a phenomenal, phenomenal piece of art.
Yes.
Like, there's no two ways about it. Like, it might have some flaws inside it, but, like, its message and its ideas are potent.
As taken as a whole, it is brilliant.
Yeah, and, like, it begins a response to Thatcherism,
As I said in the intro, it's equal parts, you know, that sort of Orwellian... Mm. Dystopian future, the Aldous Huxley kind of future. But yes, it's very much a response to conservatism, which is why we're not going to get into the movie much today, but which is why one of the problems Alan Moore had with the film was that he felt it was too much of an American sensibility, and he was very much writing about a specific period in British history.
However, I took something else away from the book, though, which was that I actually, yes, you can see the grounding is in Thatcherism. Yes, you can see the grounding is in that. But I think overall, the message of the book is about fascism.
Yes.
And that can be said anywhere.
Or anarchism anytime. Versus fascism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Or chaos versus fascism as well. Because he actually talks about anarchy and chaos.
There's
being
a
two
line very early on in the book where he's talking about the term fascism was bastardized by by fascist, basically, that the original term was a Roman term, that it was about, you know, a bundle of sticks together. It was about strength through unity.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and that
one twig can be broken, a bundle is harder to break.
And that's something that V himself would believe in, but for completely different reasons. Mm. And, you know, fascism uses it as a means of bringing about conformity, about monitoring and making sure everyone's doing the right thing, that we're all unified because we're all identical.
Yes.
Whereas he has a very different view, and that's where these two ideals collide.
Totally. And like, one of the cool things about the book is that it actually presents actually real valid arguments in favor of fascism and totalitarianism and all sorts of other. It provides
all,
like,
the isms.
All the isms. Exactly. it's actually quite even handed in a very strange way, to the point of the characterization of V himself.
Well, and like, the bottom line is, where do you draw the line? Because what one person's terrorist is another person's freedom fighter.
Mm.
And so V himself is an anti-hero in many ways, because yes, he is perceived as a terrorist. But
I've pulled a quote from Alan Moore from this book that I have of interviews with him.
What's the book called? Just so in case
it's called Alan Moore Conversations.
Okay.
And it says, he goes, "I perceive two absolute principles of politics, fascism and anarchy. All the others are just subdivisions. The only question in politics is, should we be ruled? That's what's being discussed in FIFA Vendetta, and I don't know the answer." And that's kind of really indicative of this book as a whole. Like, it's about politics and what they mean and how you as an individual fit into the political landscape.
And interestingly enough, that entire statement can be summed up in the character of Finch, because Finch is a party member. He does believe in it, but by the end, his beliefs are brought to a shaky foundation. He doesn't know what he believes anymore. He's a mess by the end.
And I think it's really interesting, because there's a running theme throughout it. Eventually, V talks in terms of anarchy being twofold. Most people see it as destruction, but he also sees anarchy as having creation, and ultimately the characters of V and Evie are flip sides of that anarchist coin.
Mm.
You know, he's about the destruction, he's about bringing the old order down, but he sees in Evie, that's why he kind of brings her into the fold, as being the next generation. You know, somebody has to bring it down, somebody has to destroy the system, somebody has to sacrifice themselves in order for the next generation to proceed. And that's a strong political message that we've seen not just here, we've seen in every major protest movement right up until the Occupy movement, which is interesting, because Alan Moore is now currently writing a very, very long essay as part of the Occupy comics. So this is a movement he's very, very strongly behind.
And which he had fights with Frank Miller about,
who misunderstood the Occupy movement, I think. But then again, Frank Miller would be in the fascist camp very firmly.
Well, now he would be. Yeah.
Now he would be, but he always had fascist leanings, Frank Miller.
Yeah, okay.
He always saw the very strong militaristic state.
Yeah,
as something that he was leaning towards. So I think this says as much about Alan Moore, but it also, the fact that it comes from a very British sensibility, because my understanding is the book started out as an attempt to create an iconic national character for Britain in the same way that the American comics had already done. That was one of the things. And I think it was actually originally taken to David Lloyd to do this. And Alan Moore then sort of came in as a collaborator. And that's where you get this. And went through various forms, I understand it, before it made it to Warrior Comics.
Mm.
And as Alan Moore says in his own introduction, as you pointed out, the first few issues, him very much finding how he presents that in a narrative, because he almost shoots his wad too early with giving us hints about V's origin,
and you almost get
that, because that's a very standard almost superhero, you know,
origin story, and what's interesting about that is, once again, if you come back to that, the film adaptation of it, a lot of the film takes place in the first half of the book.
Yes.
So it's like they've gathered all of those early scenes, and that's the foundation of this film. And it kind of, when you're reading the book for the first time, you're kind of going, I don't know where they've left themselves to go, you know? And then he finds stuff like the Valerie story and stuff like that, which is phenomenal.
Because I don't think, you know, I think this is Comics 101, regardless of what I'm about
to say. It's almost Literature 101.
It is Literature 101. I mean, and look, you know, there's very little that Frank Miller's written since this,
Frank Miller.
Well, there's very little that Frank Miller's written since.
That's
this
actually
either.
Applicable to both of them. Really.
You know, but from this point through till about League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, Almost everything Frank... Alan Miller. Everything that Alan Moore writes between that period is Comics 101, is high art, yeah. is literature. Because this is the point where he started playing with more complex narratives. Mm. This is the point where he started having multi-story structures. Mm. In fact, having stories that don't necessarily have anything that connects them to the main plot for the most part. You actually see... a couple in this that plays out throughout several issues, and you wonder how that connects until much later on.
And Alan Moore plays with the visual style of comic books to a degree where in this book in particular, his words do not always line up with the art because he's literally moved on to the next scene. The next scene is starting to play out, but they're still talking about the last scene. A very cinematic, like a voiceover. So basically, he'll be in the middle of a story, and the next panel is completely unrelated to the previous panel, but the dialogue is still related. And he's literally moved on, and he's already started playing out that next scene. And then the next scene kind of kicks over, and you sit there and go, this is like a movie. And for a person who is self-confessed as to not liking movies, he writes like a filmmaker.
I don't know if he doesn't like movies, but he doesn't. There's a quote in there where he talks against movies. He talks against film and so forth. But he is influenced by them. I mean, he works in a visual medium. Even though he started railing against films and Hollywood and the fact that Hollywood was poaching them, and he'd started deliberately writing books that couldn't be filmed. I think when he was writing, and I think a lot of the writers and artists that were coming in at that, even if he's not influenced by films, David Lloyd probably is.
Yes.
You know, so you get, even though a lot of the structure of things, and this is probably Frank Miller's, I kept stopping doing that.
Alan Moore.
Alan Moore, even this is Alan Moore's
I'm going to record Alan Moore, and we're just going to insert him at the top of all of them.
Do you remember me with Jeff Lemire? Jeff Lemire?
Yeah.
Once it's there, it's hard.
Even though this is probably Alan Moore's cue, the structure of the pages, that nine panel grid that he uses in a lot of things, and I think he even used more panels than that when by the time we got to Watchmen. Even though that structure is probably set out by him, what David Lloyd does with it is very cinematic.
Yes.
You know, but you were about to pull up you can't find
basically
it.
Like you covered all that he says in there, basically essentially. But like the interesting thing about this is because it's in the afterword of the graphic novel, at least the later edition, where he actually makes a point of saying that one of his intentions was not to use thought bubbles or what's the word for it? Like exposition bubbles. Like because he wanted this book not to be like spoon feeding you.
Yeah,
he wanted it to read and then you make your own opinion as you go. I think with V for Vendetta, it's like with any Alan Moore thing, with Watchmen, with League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, there is a feeling, it's you don't know it for sure, but there's a feeling that every single little thing is predetermined by Alan Moore. Like, and this was serialized, so, you know, at least in the first issue, maybe there were some things that were not right, but they were determined at that time. And then not till it was finished did he realize what he could improve or what he could change.
What you're saying about the speech bubbles, though, is really important because that also goes into that visual style where he'll change the scenes on you. You also, there are many panels. You've got, this is a book... deliberately makes you have to read it.
Yes.
There is no way you can skim this book because basically you've got panels changing and stories changing in mid flow, but within a panel you sometimes have to pay attention to figure out who's talking because he doesn't tell you any clean lines.
In the supplementary materials there's actually a bit of Alan Moore's script for book 2 chapter 8, and it starts off Vengeance 6 pages 1. First off, Dave, apologies for the number of frames to a page, 9 throughout. I hope this isn't too much of unnecessary graft, but I think the situation should be alleviated by the fact that there isn't much dialogue to work around, or the fact that that in a number of places you can use state both previous episodes and maybe even of the episode in hand. So he goes, I love the way he writes his script. He starts off with an apology to the artist. So harking back to what we were saying before, this is a very deliberate layout on the part of Alan Moore. So, and I think that is his anti-cinematic leanings. But then, you know, David Lloyd brings his own thing to the table. And it's really interesting the way his art style changes throughout this as well. Because the first, everything, as I understand it, everything up to issue 7 was what was originally printed in Warrior, and that was originally printed in black and white, and the colouring was done for the DC release later on. And actually, we should mention something about DC in a moment. I'll quickly mention it now. This is the book, by the way, that Alan Moore fell out with DC over. He didn't work with DC directly again following this book.
Oh, really? Okay, I thought it was later.
Except technically, League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, when Top 10 Comics was bought by DC,
right,
he found himself indirectly working for DC again, is my understanding. But David Lloyd's art, brilliant. From issue 7 onwards, you do see a slight shift in the style because it was written a bit later.
Yep.
So the new material starts from there. But again, this is a case where the pastel colors are used to enhance mood, are used to enhance light and shadow, both of which are very, very important in this book. This is a book about light and dark fighting each other as well. Dave, do you have any comments on the art?
On the art, I think the art is incredible, like especially the coloring. There's something about the coloring that sits in that space, you know, like in between like a reality and a non-reality.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like the rosy cheeks on V's face, and it's got a heightened surrealness to it. Mm. It's a magnificent book. It's a magnificent style of book. It's just you read it and you're just compelled to just sit on a page for a long time, because not only is it dense and there's a lot going on, but
there's red herrings.
So much to see, and you're just sitting there just savoring each page with the story.
This is, I think, exactly why he doesn't like cinema. Like, he's very, very clear in not liking cinema. I've got a quote here, but we should get Richard to read it out. It's just here.
You want me to do the voice?
Yeah.
Okay. I also don't like the immersive quality of film. In nearly every other medium, the audience is in control of the way in which they experience the work. At an art gallery, you can just glance at a painting or a library or stand there for a quarter of an hour or come back to it. If you read a book and you're feeling a bit tired, you can put it to one side. You can read at your own pace, but with a film, film, you're dragged throughout the experience at an unvarying 24 frames a second. I actually think that's a really interesting point.
That's what I think he means sort of by being anti-cinema. Hey, it's not necessarily like using like the like visual elements of it. It's the not being able to control
in cinema,
how
the
quickly
filmmakers
you read it.
Control it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With a book or the library or the artwork, you control it.
The library.
And the thing about comics, and I've said this before, is that comics are one of the few mediums where you're using almost all your senses together. And I think, you know, once you have enhanced audio comics, it's going to change its world. Particularly,
Hate them.
Well, maybe, but he'll hate them. But I mean, they're also doing the exact opposite of that. They're allowing you to control the pace.
God has spoken. Sorry, yeah, the audience probably can't hear that because of the new mics, but thunder just
rolled straight through. It's going, I disagree with what you just said. I think comics are one of the few mediums where you can actually, you're using a lot of senses at once. You're using that visual sense. You're doing exactly what Alan Moore said there about you're taking your pace at looking at the visuals. We spoke last week about 300 being a book that's only 80 something pages, but you take 2-3 times as long as anything else that length, because everything in there is frameable. It's like examining a picture in a gallery, but you're also reading the dialogue. You're making up, you're creating the movement between panels in your mind,
behind the panels.
There's a lot going on behind the panels. No, but you really are. I mean, this is one of the things, and a lot of people have spoken about this, is that we are actively engaged in comics in a way you aren't in any other medium, because you're making the movement happen.
Correct.
You're the other. If there's 9 frames on here, you know, you're the other bunch of frames that makes up 24.
Now, just before we wrap this up, because we are running a bit short on time, I do want to address the film adaptation briefly.
Can I just say really quickly the comic, really briefly, that like the thing about this that makes it beyond great, turns it into a masterpiece, is that he manages to juggle amazing, amazing characterization.
Yes.
Like, the character of Evie and V are just stunning in how well drawn they are.
But I think all of the villains of the piece are also incredibly well drawn. I think the character of Susan is fascinating. Sitting there in front of fate the whole time, and just that falling into despair without really saying much at all.
And also just how much and how little we're given of his background. And in fact, when they do go back, at one point one of the characters goes back to try and work things out. He does so when he's taking acid. He's dropped acid to try and get V's brain. So again, we don't know how reliable some of this backstory is. And that's what I love about this, that we kind of get things, everything's through a filter.
And everything, yeah, and everything is thrown upside down. Like, they find the doctor's journal. They yeah. read the doctor's journal, which paints a very, very vivid picture.
But
and immediately
go,
and, but
yeah.
then he immediately also goes, how do we know V didn't write it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's like, you go, oh, damn it.
Yeah.
You know, so all the way through it, there is an unreliable storyteller all the way through it. Because
yes.
you just never know. What's real and what's not. I do want to address the film adaptation very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. We won't harp on it at all because we're not a film show. But just to say that there's two schools of thought on the film. Some people really dislike the film, and some people have actually really
including
liked
Alan
the film.
Moore.
Including Alan Moore. I actually rewatched the film last night, and I actually really enjoyed it. I saw it at the cinema, and I quite enjoyed it. And I saw the film before I read the book.
Yeah.
It actually made me want to read the book, and I actually liked the book better. But I think the film is a beast of its own, and I think the most important thing about the film is that it, when distilled down, it is actually addressing exactly the same concept. And I think what they've done is they've taken it, they distilled down what is essentially unfilmable material and turned it into a popcorn film that does still deliver a message. Mm. And that message is, and I was saying to you guys before, and I've actually got two sound clips we'll play really quickly. If you can distill it down to two ideas, and they're the two ideas that are in the book and in the film. One of them is this one.
Why won't you die?
Beneath this mask, there is more than flesh. Beneath this mask, there is an idea, Mr. Creedy. And ideas are bulletproof.
Which I think is probably, in fact, we might even skip the second clip. The most important point is that it is about an ideal. And if you can actually form that ideal, whether it's whatever political stance you have, if you can make people follow that ideal, it has power.
Just like in Batman Begins.
Why do we fall down, Richard?
So we can get back up, Master Bruce.
So I do say that if you haven't seen the film in a while, or you haven't seen the film for whatever reason, have a look at it. Just be aware it isn't the book.
Just realize my Michael Caine's about two shades away from my Alan Moore. Again, David, this is Comics 101.
This is
Comics 101.
And I think that's all we need to say on that book for now. Next week, we will be looking at something that we're going to tell you a little bit about after the feedback. And if it's feedback, I think that's time for a girl to pay us a visit. Hey, girls. In fact, girls form a large basis of the feedback this week. First of all, we have some feedback from Nancy Lahr, who has written into us via our Facebook page. Nancy's written into us before, but this says, but this week she just says, just listen to your latest podcast. The proposal to Kate would be awesomely funny to listen to. Please make this happen, smiley face. But Kate hasn't remained silent on this topic either. Those of you who didn't tune in last week, David made the suggestion that Dave should propose to our new best listener, Kate. And I suggested that we might have just lost our new best listener as a result of this. But Kate is not going anywhere anytime soon. She says to Richard, David, and Dave, so I'm confused. Who am I supposed to be engaged to? I think it's Dave. As you can read, I'm still here and listening. I did laugh quite a bit while listening to this podcast, which was not so great as I was at work at the time. Embarrassing. I do, however, have a question. I am giving some serious thought to going to the Sydney Oz Comic Con. Yes, I live in Sydney. There you go, Dave. though the lineup looks good to me, I was wondering if you guys think of the what would you guys think of the lineup, and if you think it's worth shelling out a bit more money and getting a priority or even a platinum pass. I've never been to an Oz Comic Con. I've always wanted to go, and since listening to you guys, I've been giving this some very serious thought again. Thanks, guys, and keep up the great work. Still a fan. Kate.
And Kate, now, before we go any further, I'm going to say, Kate, have you met Dave?
They told me before this that we had some feedback from Kate and that I should just be prepared. That was nothing.
I don't think a proposal is nothing.
I was expecting, like, I've been sitting here for an hour and a half expecting Kate to write, like, oh, I'd never want to be, you know, like,
to be fair,
he sounds like an asshole.
She hasn't said yes yet. But
I was expecting, like, you know, if you guys are going to be there at the Comic Con, please don't bring Dave.
To answer your question, though, Kate.
Kate, that was very sweet.
Look, I mean, again, humbled every week by the feedback we get. But to answer your question about Oz Comic Con, we have nothing but good things to say about Oz Comic Con. They're good friends of ours. We've worked with them a lot before. We'll be at the Sydney Oz Comic Con. So that's one of the best reasons to come along, to come and meet us and hang out
with us. But what kind of pass should she get?
Look, having been to a few Oz Comic Cons myself, I went to the Melbourne one last year. The lining up, if you just want to see the guests, you want to hear them talk, you might just want to get a standard ticket, because if you line up early enough, you can get into the tents and so forth, and it'll be a different setup at Sydney, but you can just line up early, go and see them, listen to them. You get your tokens to go and get, if you've got a specific person you want to see, and that's the only reason you're going, it might be worth your time to get a pass for that person if it's available.
Right.
Because excellent stuff. You really jump through queues with some of the things, and you get really good, you get priority signed autographs and photos and all that kind of thing. So if you're there to see that person, and that is going to be the highlight of your life, you know, go do it. You know, we've got slightly different perspectives because we're media. So we often get to meet some of these people, you know, by the by, or we get to skip to the line. Though I didn't. I got kind of went as a punter to Oz Comic Con Melbourne last year. I got a bit of media treatment, but I kind of lined up for everything just to see what the process was like. And it's really good. So I think if you're going, but, you know, whatever you can afford. I know as much as we love Oz Comic Con, con tickets aren't always cheap.
No.
So do with what you can afford. The best thing about a con, if you haven't been for a while, is the people there. You're going to spend a lot of time hanging out with, cosplayers.
And if you do come, make sure you look for us, because
we'll interview you. We'll put your voice on the show.
And we're
doing a live proposal at Oz Comic Con Sydney.
If all goes well, we'll be recording.
What if she's
the show
really
floor.
Cool?
Then
what do you mean? What if she's really,
she's really cool? and Dave, when you meet her, we will be expecting you to get down on one knee. All right?
It's been a long day. And he's really tired.
Will we be there both days? We will be.
Oh yeah, we will be. Yeah.
Like just look for the free Doctor Who's. Right? Is that what we're gonna? Have we decided? Or we?
No, I'll be going as the blonde.
No, you're going as Doctor Strange, aren't you,
Richard? I'm going as Squirtle.
I'm going to go as a groom, I think. You know?
So, really, but look, we'll definitely be there. I'm going. Like, I haven't actually bought my plane tickets yet, but I'm meant to be going to Adelaide Oz Comic Con in a couple of weeks. Let's see how that happens.
Yeah, have fun with that.
I might end up not.
Did you just make a Malaysian Airlines reference?
No.
You're like, I might not come back or something?
No, I might, or
I might
not.
Not.
Oh,
right, okay.
Dave, before the show, Dave's desperate for us to do a Malaysian Airlines plane special, because we're all fascinated by what's
obsessed,
happened to this plane.
As is everybody in the world at the moment.
Long story short, go to Oz Comic Con Sydney.
And please, before we go any further, keep your hate mail. We're not making light of the Malaysian airline thing.
We just need to go back to
the
island.
No, we actually genuinely find it fascinating.
It's fascinating.
The other bit of email I received this week was from Craig Bruin, who is the author of an Australian book called From Above, which I've actually got the first couple of issues I bought from Kings because it just looked interesting.
Okay.
He's apart from the fact that he's wanting us to read his book, which we will, because he's very kindly offered to send us some copies.
Cool.
But he also wanted to say that he loves the podcast that we do, incredibly informative, and the three of you have a great, easy-to-listen-to dynamic that is highly entertaining. I find your reviews of the books to be really insightful, and the whole vibe and presentation of the show highly polished and professional, except for this one, obviously.
Now, Craig, like, behind the scenes, we actually really hate each other, so yeah. This is all put on.
in fact, we're not even in the same room recording.
We have mics set up in four different rooms.
We record.
We don't even
really
talk.
I just come in, I drop my stuff on a Saturday morning, and then
we listen back to it, going, "Yeah."
That's a
really, I agree with you, Richard.
Really valid comment, Richard. Oh no, wait, I was not supposed to say that, was I? Look, again, amazing feedback. Thanks, guys. Next week we will be doing a book called Doctor Strange: The Oath.
I don't know what I'm getting myself into.
Look, this is meant to be a good... We just wanted to read a Doctor Strange book, and this is meant to be a good Doctor Strange book by none other than Brian K. Vaughan, who we think writes a good book. And if that's,
sort of.
If that's not good enough, the artist on this book is Marcos Martin, or Marcos Martin, if you prefer, who is the current artist. Basically, they're the team that does The Private Eye, the digital comic, which
right,
is
right.
The Behind the Panels award-winning digital comic and artist team.
We gave Brian K. Vaughan a few awards.
We gave Brian K. Vaughan scooped the first
annual... He is the master.
The first annual panelsies.
Has the... Just out of curiosity, just very quickly, is the third trade of Saga out yet?
Not yet.
I think it's very coming out soon. Late this month or early next, excellent. Early April, I think, yeah.
They're off at the moment, so it should be next week.
It's
get Saga, people.
Get into, if you haven't read Saga.
Go buy the trades. It's easy to digest.
That's the book that you want to read. And in fact, it's both volumes of the Saga that are out at the moment. In that story we read before about the top 20 comic books. It's like basically it was like six books from The Walking Dead, six books from Attack on Titan, two volumes of Saga, a bunch of anime, or a bunch of manga stuff, and an adaptation of Miss Perigue's Home for Peculiar Children, or whatever it's called. That was the top 20 trade paperbacks that were sold to bookstores.
Wow.
No capes. No capes majors in the top 20 at all. I think that's a shift of what... Showing to me where mainstream comics are going for people who aren't us.
Who aren't comic book fans. Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that's just really fascinating. But until next week, you can find me on Twitter at DVDBits. That's where I plug all my stuff. You can also find me at TheRealBits.com and, of course, BehindThePanels.net.
You can find me at GeekActually.com or on Twitter at David McVeigh.
You can find me on Twitter at Dave Longo or DamnGoodCup.com, where there is nothing there at all. It's an absolute wasteland. I'm paying money to keep it going, but I don't know if I will.
It's your legacy.
To be fair.
That's right, it's my legacy.
To be fair, it's a little bit like The Real Bits at the moment. But
And thanks, Craig. Thanks, Kate. We love you guys.
Yeah, absolutely, guys.
And all of you out there.
All of you. Even the ones who didn't be bothered writing in.
We will never meet.
Oh, we should
say. We will never hug. We will never kiss. But believe this. I love you.
Until next week, when you'll join us again, I'm sure, for Doctor Strange, The Oath. I'm Richard Gray.
I'm David McVeigh.
And I'm David Longo.
And this is Behind the Panels.